Welcome to season 4 of the Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you so much for taking some time with me today to take a look at the objects our Near Eastern ancestors left behind and consider if those just might change how we read or read into scripture. When my trip to Israel was canceled this past summer, I really struggled with exactly what I wanted to do for season 4 of the podcast. I had made all of these plans and suddenly they just went away. So I talked to the people who knew me best, who know my brand best, my husband, my best friend, my parents, my dog, and importantly, my agent and the wonderful women at Redbird Social, who are very busy teaching me everything that I am slowly learning about social media. And the consensus was that maybe this was an opportunity for me to introduce everybody to the period of ancient history that really gets me the most excited. And that is the Iron Age, specifically in the Levantine region. When I was an undergrad, my advisor was a gentleman named Steve McKenzie, and he had just written a book called King David. It came out, I think, within a few months of me starting college, and he was considered really to be the world's foremost authority on King David. I still think of him that way today. And then when I got to grad school, one of my advisors was Lawrence Stager, and he, of course, was the dig director at Ashkelon, a Philistine site for 40 years, for a very, very long time. And so these men, because of their specialty and because of their passion about what they were discovering, what they were writing about, what they were teaching, that really rubbed off on me. And so that's probably why, or part of the reason why, the Iron Age is really the part of Israel's ancient history that that I feel the most comfortable talking about and that I really enjoy sharing with other people. Before we dive into that content, I thought it might be a good idea to start off by saying what exactly Iron Age means. So in the ancient Near East, the Iron Age is usually described as being between 1200 and either 586 BCE, when the Neo-Babylonians came in and conquered and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, or sometimes it's described as being as ending in 539 when the Persians conquered the Neo-Babylonians. But somewhere in the 6th century is where we have a transition from the Iron Age into the next era of civilization. So two things happened at the beginning of that in 1200. The first is that iron smelting was developed. And you will notice that the era takes its name from iron because that is the tool that became the most dominant for everything from agricultural tools to, of course, weapons. And this is the way that archaeologists and anthropologists name a lot of the different ages of the world based on whatever was the most popular, most important, the best technology at the time. And so prior to the Iron Age, we have the Bronze Age because bronze tools are being used. Before that, we have the Copper Age, the Chalcolithic, but it basically means the Copper Age. And then prior to that is Neolithic, or what is popularly called the Stone Age. And so that's where the name Iron Age comes from. But I think it is really important to note that just because it is the Iron Age in the Levant does not mean that the Iron Age occurred at the same time all over the rest of the world. And so if, for instance, you go to Great Britain or someplace in Western Europe, they also have an Iron Age, but their Iron Age doesn't begin until 800 or maybe even as late as 500 BCE, because that is when the iron technology and the tools and everything really made their way into those regions. And so when someone's talking about the Iron Age, it's important to know where in the world they're talking about and not just when in the world. So that's the Iron Age in Israel. The second thing that happened in 1200, beyond just iron smelting being developed, was the arrival of the Sea Peoples on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean. These were 9 distinct groups of people who came from the regions of Cyprus, the Aegean Sea, that area of the Mediterranean Sea, and they came into Egypt and started attacking and marauding, and they actually end up bringing about the end of that particular area of civilization for Egypt. Well, after the initial struggles between Egypt and the sea peoples end up moving up along the coast of the Mediterranean and going into Canaanite cities. And so we start to see, for example, in Ashkelon, a transition of culture from a pure Canaanite culture into a Philistine culture. There is debate out there about whether or not this change from Canaanite to Philistine was the result of wars, of the Philistines coming in, tromping on everybody with their advanced materials and their advanced war-making ability, their giant chariots, all of those things. Was it an active military thing that happened there, or did they just move in and then slowly over time the cultures merged and the Philistine culture ended up taking over? This is something that is debated in the area, but what we see in 1200 is a shift away from Canaanite culture and toward Philistine culture in some way or another. So these are the two things, the development of iron and the arrival of the sea peoples, that really start what we call the Iron Age in the Levant. I would encourage you, if you want to learn more about the sea peoples, why we call them that, why maybe that's not the best name in the world, exactly what they did with Egypt and the surrounding areas, I encourage you to go back and check out season 3, episode 7 of my podcast. I have an entire episode devoted to them, which they absolutely deserve. The Philistines were a fascinating culture, and they kind of get a raw deal these days. So please check that out if you are at all curious about the sea peoples. Well, so around the same time that the Philistines are conquering, or maybe just blending in with the Canaanites, it depends on who you ask. About the time that was happening, the Israelite tribes are also returning to the region from Egypt. They had wandered in the wilderness area of what would become the nation of Israel for a generation, and they wandered until everyone died off, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. So in the books of Joshua and Judges, we read there about how under Joshua, the areas were divided up geographically among the different tribes of Israel. We learn who a lot of the judges were. And by judges, sometimes that means, yes, judges as we think about it, laying out rules, but that could also mean generals or governors of the area. Judges is a sort of unique term in the way that it is used in the Bible. And then we also learn how those Bibles went. So a little bit of a spoiler alert if you haven't spent a whole lot of time in the books of Joshua and Judges yet, but not all of the judges were really great leaders. And the Israelites did not win every single battle that they engaged in. Maybe one of the biggest examples of this is the tribe of Dan. They were initially allotted the area that was just to the north of where the Philistines were residing, of Philistia. And in spite of the best efforts of one of the most famous judges, Samson, the tribe of Dan was not able to conquer the area of land that had been allotted to them. And so that entire tribe actually ended up moving north and forming what would become the northernmost border of the nation of Israel. Well, so growing up, I know I just had this feeling that the conquest of Canaan had to have come easy. God ordained it, and therefore it happened very, very smoothly. But what we read in Joshua, and especially in the book of Judges, is that these battles, these attempts at conquering, were anything but easy. The books include so many mistakes and flat out failures and really, really gory episodes. But yes, they also include a record of all the successes that the Israelites experienced at the time. And so in places like Joshua and Judges, where the biblical narrative isn't particularly easy for us to read or to understand, then that reminds me that what we call the Bible, specifically the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, depending on what tradition you're coming to it from, those books at the time were also ancient Israel's historical record of the nation. Other contemporary nations at the time, so the Egyptians, and a little bit later, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, all of these countries left behind copious records. If you go to Egypt, if you're in, say, Thebes, you cannot walk through a building without seeing beautifully colored hieroglyphics everywhere. And those hieroglyphics tell a story. And a lot of that is the history of ancient Egypt. Well, with Israel, we don't have a whole lot of that. What we have are what is in the Hebrew Bible. That is also the historical record of Israel. Well, if you're reading in 1st and 2nd Kings, you will notice that occasionally you'll have maybe a few verses telling a short snippet of the story, but it has the tone of, you know, yeah, I, the scribe writing this down, I'm reminding you of this thing that happened here. But if you want more details, then you need to go to the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah or the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. These two documents, we don't have them. And I know growing up, I thought that what was meant by that were the books of Chronicles in our Bible. It's not. The books of Chronicles are completely separate. They were written later. And I think we'll actually talk about those a bit in the last episode of this season. But what is referred to in 1st and 2nd Kings, we have not found those. And so when people ask me, like, what is the number one thing that you want to see found in Israel? Honestly, for me, it's that. I would love it if we had even more information about the historical goings on of ancient Israel. So hopefully one day we will find those. Hopefully they are out there somewhere. Something like finding the Ark of the Covenant or the Cup of Christ, those would be really cool. And I would be the first in line in a museum to go see those items, but they wouldn't necessarily be beneficial. Finding more written historical records really could tell us so much. So that is that for me, that big thing that's just sitting out there, hopefully somewhere, just waiting to be found, maybe in my lifetime. That would be glorious if that were the case. So now that I have bored you entirely with this little history lesson about the Iron Age and the Israelite tribes before Israel as a nation, let's go ahead and talk about that last judge of Israel's tribes. His name is Samuel. And the first king of Israel, his name is Saul. So in the book of Samuel, which in the original scrolls, it is one book, it is not two. That gets broken down in our translations that way. The book of Samuel, forgive me if you just heard that. The perils of recording something like this at home is that I believe this is my third attempt at this because I had a moment where my bassinet just started going nuts in the other room and I have absolutely no clue why. And it's nearly 5 p.m. So I think people are speeding home from work outside of my window right now. So anyway, welcome to my world. Welcome to my office. This is what it's like to work with me on a daily basis. Oh, here, I'll take a sip as I digressed. So, the book of Samuel, one book, not two books. It opens with the story of how the judge and prophet Samuel was conceived. And the last bit of Judges, so the last verse that you read before you move into 1 Samuel is, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what seemed right to him. So you have that closing in Judges 21:25, and that is really a fantastic foreshadowing of what is going to happen really in the next four books of the Bible. I've always really loved Samuel and his story and really his mother, Hannah. My husband and I struggled with infertility for about 7 years. We had multiple miscarriages. And I know something that I did was pray Hannah's prayers most nights for many, many, many years. And as a result of that, I understand what Hannah was praying for. Hannah went and she told God, if you give me a son, I am going to take him to the high place in Shiloh, and he is going to be raised by the priest there, and he is going to serve you all the days of your life. He will be a Nazarite. The same thing that Samson was. So his hair would never be cut. Alcohol would never touch his lips, you know, that sort of thing. And so I used to pray these prayers, honestly, even knowing in the back of my mind, you know, there was no way that I probably wouldn't cut my children's hair or something like that. But anyway, I have loved her as a Bible character for many, many years. And that's part of the reason I think I enjoy Samuel's story so much, because he was not just an answer to Hannah's prayers, but he also was absolutely invaluable when it comes to the change from Israel as a group of 12 independent tribes over into Israel as a nation. He was completely necessary for that to happen. So the books of Samuel tell the story of course, Samuel and Saul and David. And what Samuel and Kings really are, it's a story of a nation, of God's people. They looked at him and said, we want to have a king. We want to be ruled by a human, just like everybody else around us. That is not what God wanted. God wanted Israel to be a pure theocracy, which is not something that we have ever experienced in human history. But God envisioned being the leader of his people himself, and they're not needing to be a king over them. But the Israelites made enough noise that God acquiesced to this. So your first little bit of archaeology for this episode is in 2008, during an excavation at Kirbet Kaifa, which is it is a city that many people connect with the biblical city of Sha'arayim, which is a border city between Philistia and Judah. It's mentioned during the reign of David in the 11th century. Well, in this city, there is a piece of broken pottery that was found. And on this piece of broken pottery, somebody had written down words that roughly agree with the words in 1 Samuel 8. In 1 Samuel 8, that is where Samuel describes to the people what is going to happen if they actually get what they want. And that is essentially that when you have a human over you, that you are going to be oppressed. And in his way, Samuel is trying to talk everybody out of this demand that they are making of God to have a human king. But he is warning them. He is warning the Israelite tribes against requesting this king. Well, so someone who heard what Samuel had to say obviously thought that it was important enough that he sat down, and probably he, most scribes at the time, of course, were male, but he sat down and, you know, got his stylus and made his ink and recorded the words of this warning. This particular artifact is not completely understood. And so if you go to the show notes, I am putting a link in there so that you can see images of this, see more images of this particular artifact. You can also read what different scholars have to say about it. There's disagreement about if it's Hebrew or if it's Proto-Hebrew or if it's even Phoenician, if it should be read from top to bottom or bottom to top. There's lots of disagreement there. But what I see in this is simply an artifact that is, you know, it's a little bit of written history, and it's something we don't know who wrote it, but the words that are there coincide with the sentiment at the time that the people would have been hearing from the judge Samuel, that, hey guys, I'm telling you, you don't want this. You think you want this. You really don't want this. Well, of course, in the end, Samuel ends up going and he anoints Saul. Well, so the way this goes is Saul one day is out searching for his father's lost donkeys. And in brief, he ends up finding Samuel, and the two of them have a dinner together. The next morning, Samuel anoints Saul, and then they break apart. Sometime later, and we don't know any more than that. It could have been a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, a few years. We don't know. The Bible just says sometime later, Samuel goes and he calls all the leaders of the tribes together. And first, he accuses them of rejecting God in favor of some unknown human ruler who, you know, they don't know who this guy is going to be. But he tells them that, you know what, God is going to do it. You are going to get a king. And so he gets the tribes to engage in drawing lots. And as they do this, as they go through this practice at the very end, of course, Saul is the one who is chosen. Of course, what's kind of funny about this is as they're doing this, you know, Samuel's sitting there knowing, yeah, it's going to be Saul because I've already anointed him. So everything happened maybe a little bit backwards from the perspective of the Israelites had they known that it had gone down in this order. So it's just, I don't know, something that's just kind of funny to me. Well, because of inexact English translations, I knew that I grew up thinking that casting lots or drawing lots was basically all of these guys sitting down and playing one big giant game of dice, and that somehow that was how they divined an answer or decided an answer or something like that. You see lots mentioned frequently in the Old Testament and the New Testament. They are tools for decision making. They can be tools for divination. But what would actually happen is that people would take a piece of pottery and they would write something on it, whatever they were trying to decide. In this case, it was probably, you know, a name, or it was a name. So, you know, to begin with, each of the heads of the tribes would take a piece, they'd write the tribe's name on it, and then they would cast the lot into some sort of a vessel. Maybe it was a bowl or a bag or, you know, something like that. And then whoever was in charge of this process, in this case Samuel, then he would draw lots out of that vessel. And that is how decisions were made at the time. If this sounds maybe sort of kind of familiar, but you're not quite placing it, I'm going to link in the show notes to another article that is actually about the lots that were discovered at Masada. For many, many centuries, it was thought that the Jews who were living at the top of Masada, just before the Roman army came in, that they entered into a murder-suicide pact with one another, and that the men drew lots or cast lots, however you want to say it, and they determined which men would murder everyone else who was living up there, and then they would turn on each other, and then ultimately one person would be left to commit suicide. This is the story that Josephus tells. Well, since archaeologists have gotten up there and have excavated a lot of Masada and put it back together, what has been discovered is that the material evidence that is up there doesn't actually coincide with what Josephus says. Josephus says there's one palace, there are multiple palaces. There are just lots of problems with his account that don't match the fact that, I mean, there wasn't a graveyard of bones that was found up there for that reason. Well, anyway, if you're curious about lots and about Masada, go into those show notes. I've got a link for you there and read more about it. I don't know that we know yet exactly what was happening at Masada, but the thought now is that those lots that were discovered, they weren't there because of a murder-suicide pact. They were there because, quite simply, that's the way the Jews living there were administering the city. Because, you know, it had to be decided, you know, who was going to take the trash out, who was going to haul water up to the top of the city, who was going to tend to the vineyard, you know, various things, all the duties that needed to be done in a city to keep it going. Well, it had to be decided who was going to get the good jobs and who was going to get the bad jobs. And so now it is thought that's probably actually what the lots were left behind from, not a murder-suicide pact. I really hope that that's true. I like that version a little bit better. It's a little bit softer, gentler version. It's not so much a judge's version of what happened at Masada. Well, Saul, as he becomes king, his time is incredibly tumultuous. And it was tumultuous, honestly, long before David even came onto the scene. Of course, when David comes onto the scene, Saul loses it. We'll talk about that next week. But although the tribes technically got together, went through this administrative process, and they think that they chose Saul, he was anointed by Samuel, the reality is that the tribes never completely fell in line behind Saul. He was never really able to put Israel together as a completely cohesive country. We really understand that they were factionalized because of how relatively easy it was for David to come in and start splintering tribes off while Saul was still alive and, you know, before David took sole control of Israel as it was. The reality is, when Saul according to the Bible, when Saul becomes king, he is not great at following instructions. He's not great at following God's instructions. There is an episode where he goes and he makes a sacrifice, but of course, he is not a Levite. He is not a priest. He did not have a right to do that. Later, he is told to go and kill all the Amalekites, men, women, children, all the animals. He doesn't do that. So, you know, he's not in the best graces with God. And in 1 Samuel 15:11, God actually states, "I regret that I made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and from executing my commands." After God says this, it says that Samuel weeps all night at this declaration. But Samuel picks himself up, because in the very next chapter, he goes and he anoints Israel's next king. Join me next week when we meet David, a young man who would be the first king of a truly united Israel. Under him, all tribes unite, the capital is founded in Jerusalem, and the Ark of the Covenant finds its resting place. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yurimkiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram. Then check out my website, redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.